Hello and welcome to the Text Messages Podcast, a podcast where we have conversations about our modern lives grounded in Jewish text. I hope you enjoy and follow along. You're welcome to either just listen or, as always, to pull out a Tanakh, a Jewish Bible, and follow along. Either way, we hope you find it to be meaningful and that you feel connected to something that is grounded in ancient tradition while you listen. All right, so I am here again with Jonah and with Rabbi Alan Ullman, and we are here to record another podcast. And I guess I'll start things off today. So I have been thinking a lot about what it means to be seeing the future. And there's a lot of talk right now of reopening and how that's going to go and what the world is going to look like when we get back to quote unquote normal. And I had this moment the other day where I actually got up and got dressed and gathered all my things. I gathered, you know, the purse I hadn't touched in a very long time. And I got my keys out and I got in the car and I drove to Temple Beth Elohim, to do a there were some things I needed to assemble for a project and things I was going to prepare. And I got there, the building was empty, I was the only person in it. And on one hand, it felt very normal. You know, there, I actually nearly cried as I sort of like pulled into the parking lot and felt just like this sense of like, oh, we're home, I'm back, it's so great. And then nothing was normal. You know, the building was much more empty than I've ever seen it before. And I was wearing masks the entire time and gloves. And when I saw people, everyone else, you know, I was passing out these kits and I was standing 30 feet away from people. And it just felt both very comforting and the same and also very confusingly different. And so that's sort of what led us, I think, to this conversation today about what does it look like to approach a very different normal, something that is never really going to look like the past, and may be very different for quite a time. And how are we different as we approach that?
So we're in Deuteronomy 30, verses 1 through 6, and this is on pages 440 and 441, if you happen to be in JPS. And if you could take a moment and read through, and then we'll dive in. So let's start with our two fundamental questions. Where are we in physical space in the movement of the Israelites through the wilderness, and where are we in time?
So in space, we are about to enter the promised land, but we're still in the wilderness. And in time, is this year 39 or year 40? This is year 40.
Yep, you're absolutely right on both counts. We are in the wilderness, but fascinatingly enough, we're not in Sinai. We're actually in modern day Jordan, but still it would be considered the Midbar. And if you're in a modern day state of Israel, say you're at the Dead Sea and you're looking east, you see a plain across from, which is modern day Jordan before you would hit the brownish colored mountains, which are the mountains of Moab. And all of that on the other side of the Jordan River, on the east side of the Jordan, is modern day Jordan. And the Israelites are camped there. And it's year 40. And what are some of the implications of saying that it is year 40? Aside from the fact that they're literally about to go in.
It's a new generation, the generation that wasn't in Egypt.
Okay, bravo. It's the generation that was born of the wilderness, meaning the generation that was born of Egypt has all passed except for three, Moses and Joshua and Caleb. And so there's a lot of implications to that. What are some of the implications of that?
So I think one of the implications is that they've had 40 years of Shabbat. They've had 40 years of Pesach. They've had sort of the festival, the main festival holidays, correct? They've had Sukkot, they've had Shavuot, and so they've sort of been living in this cycle of sacred time, and they've also had with that, you know, they've also had manna, as we talked about a couple of sessions ago, and so everything that they've had has been provided by God.
Right. And they've had the opportunity, everything you say, they've also had the tabernacle that has been at the center of the camp and went with them everywhere in the wilderness, the pillar of cloud by day, something that looks like fire by night. But I want to suggest they've had an opportunity to transition from thinking of God as Pharaoh and all the implications of that to thinking of God in a very alternative model as a moving transitional verb rather than a static keeping one in place noun. And if I had to pick, actually, one of the things that I think marks through religionists of all varieties, it wouldn't matter to me if you were talking Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, we could just go on and on. Those who think of God or any authority of a higher varietal as oppressing them and keeping them in a static position. And those who have come to see a verb sense, an emotion sense of creational authority. And what does it mean to see God or authority that way? So that's a huge transition, and it's a transition that's happened both on an individual, but in more specifically, and perhaps every bit as importantly, on a communal level. How does a community see when it sees? So, yeah, you're looking like at least three thoughts, Hannah.
Well, I'm thinking that this is the section of time where I think God has been most obviously present. And not in sort of the way of big miracles, but well, and also that, I guess, but more in the way of just constant moving presence with the people in a way that's, you know, both had physical representation of sort of carrying the Mishkan with them and the moments on the moment of revelation on Mount Sinai, but also in this sort of like the nurturing manna way, you know, it's been so clear and so present for all of these people, possibly for their entire lives, that God is just very present to them. And for me, I feel like in this last period of time, it's been a time where, you know, Shabbat is incredibly present to me, where, you know, I really take 24 hours and it's Shabbat. And where I'm so much more aware of noticing everything around. You know, it feels very much like we've been in the Midbar and it's been very present. And how to kind of, you know, one of my questions is how to hold that presence, carrying it forward, and not to lose it.
Care for a little detour?
Love detours.
Let's go. Ecclesiastes chapter 11, page 1782. So if you're in JPS listening to this, Ecclesiastes chapter 11, page 1782, and we are in verses 1-4. And I'll just read it out real fast. Send your bread forth upon the waters, for after many days you will find it. Distribute portions to seven or even to eight, for you cannot know what misfortune may occur on earth. If the clouds are filled, they will pour down rain on the earth, and if a tree falls to the south or to the north, the tree will stay where it falls. If one guards the wind, one will never sow. And if one observes the clouds, one will never reap. Now, in verse 4, it says, Shomer Ruach. Now, Shomer is the verb to guard, like guarding Shabbat, Vishamru. But here, it's guarding Ruach. And fascinatingly enough, guarding Ruach is described as what?
Well, it's a bad thing, in a sense. You know, if you guard Ruach too closely, it's like you're like trying to hold on to really hard to something that is like going, that should just be sort of flowing.
For me personally, it's one of the biggest keys to all teaching. It's just wherever it goes is where it's going. If I try to guard it or direct it too tightly, it actually loses it. I want to suggest it's about learning to do what? Well, not to be difficult, because my brain just simply, or my heart, goes to a text. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. So even when I'm walking someplace wildly dangerous, oh, there's God. So all I'm trying to get at here is, the great question is, and I'm being very personal for a second, do I trust the room when I'm teaching a passage I've never taught before, and I don't actually know that I even have any clue what the answers are? Now let's see how trusting I can be. But in a sense, I want to suggest that's all our lives. We're always hitting new passages. And can we step into them with trust? Now, that's real easy to say, of course. And comments, thoughts, about to go on.
There's this, again, on the Wednesday that I described, where I went into Temple Beth Elohim and came home. There was the moment where I came home at the end of the day and I was like, oh, you know, like I got to take my mask off and I got to go inside and be home. And it sort of felt like, you know, the comfort of returning to what had become known. And it, you know, it wasn't that I wasn't sad that I, or disappointed that I'd gone in and gotten to be sort of more out in the world and see a sense of what the future would be like. You know, it was great to see everyone. It was great to be there. It was great to feel like there was a sense of moving forward. But it was, you know, it's still terrifying. You know, it was still unknown. It was like a completely, even though I knew where it was going, it was still completely uncertain and pretty terrifying to be learning new ways of interacting and connecting with other people.
As my favorite teacher back in rabbinical school used to say, if you ain't scared, you ain't there. And I think, so I'm not saying that being scared is a problematic. Actually, I'm saying it's kind of a compass in a way. And there's a very famous verse, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. But that word for fear also means awe or reverence. So it's not so much fear of somebody coming at us with a big stick as what does it mean to be in a state of awe or reverence, which can also include dimensions of fear. Okay, unless there are any other comments, thoughts, let's get back to Deuteronomy 30. So we're back on page 440, and in verse 1, even though we're in year 40 and we're about to enter the promised land, what are we talking about in verse 1?
Egypt?
Perhaps if you give me a different word, then I could say yes or no.
The narrow place?
Not to be difficult. We're talking about, fascinatingly enough, being in exile. Now, could exile be Egypt? For sure. Yeah. But we're so here we are talking about being in exile. Does that make sense from just reading verse one? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So we're talking about being in exile, but exile won't happen for another 700 or so years. So there's kind of a question that's begging to be asked here.
Why are you getting a warning that's so far in the future? And also, you know, it's sort of like you're being told, like, you're going to be guests in this house, but you're going to have to leave it at some point. Like, you will leave it at some point. It's okay. Not yours.
Oh, well, Hannah, if you're going to be that profound that fast. real quick, because, wow, Hannah. So we are in Leviticus 25, and it's page 266, and we're in verse 23. So page 266, Leviticus 25, verse 23, and I'll just read it out loud. But the land must not be sold beyond reclaim, for the land is mine, capital M. You are but strangers resident with me. In other words, if you could just repeat what you just said, Hannah, let's start to unpack this a little bit.
Right. So we tend to think this is ours. It belongs to the land. We might think, especially if you're entering the promised land, that the land belongs to the people. And by a reminder that you're going to be leaving it, it's sort of a reminder that it's not yours. You're a guest. And when you're a guest, one of the key things that you know is that at some point you're going to be leaving. You're not there forever.
I just think you've leapt so many tall buildings. The idea of who owns the land. And the answer is, no, not any me with a small m. There's only one who owns the land, and that's God. And what does it mean to see ourselves as guests? And how would we act if we saw ourselves as guests? Okay, huge questions all. When let's make this an all play. When we are guests in somebody else's home, space, place, because I mean, we could be guests in a national park. How do we act?
Well, you try to leave everything as you found it, or perhaps slightly better, but not in a way that sort of disrespects what the owners might want. Like in a literal way, you like clean up after yourself and you make sure that you don't break anything, but it's just a sense of sort of greater respect to the space and to everything that's around you, and just a sense of awareness of like where you leave things, what you do with things. You're not sort of just throwing your stuff everywhere or leaving the dishes in the sink for hours on end. You're much more keenly aware of everything having a place and making sure that you're treating it with respect.
So one of the biggest compliments I can ever get, and I happen to stay in a lot of people's homes all over the world, is that when people say, oh, you're an easy guest, meaning there's something about being in the house that is not causing people to have to act differently. That the house can just kind of be the house. And to me, that's one of my goals, that everybody gets to be themselves. But I also mean that if I'm talking about being a parent, or if I'm talking about being a friend, or if I'm talking about teaching a study session, the whole point is everybody gets to be themselves. They don't have to. Or maybe just everybody gets to meet each other being themselves.
Our traditional notion of death, though, is still getting in the way a little bit, because me resonating with both of your responses, is still about leaving the place the same, even though you two have lived there now or existed there. And I'm getting that a little bit from Ecclesiastes, especially in the tree falling, only falling and on a certain place and being left there. And the references, like the arrow only striking the ground where it lands. And I think that when we're truly the best guest we can, sure, we allow the people in that home to be themselves openly, but to be themselves with us too. And I think that means that there will be inevitable change when somebody, you go to a new place, you or somebody welcomes a new person into their space. There has to be change. It's just that we are almost more whole in that moment.
Okay, you've left such a tall building, Jonah. Mega bravo. And Hannah, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, so, okay, this made me think of like 10 different things, and one of them is really small and one of them is really big. So I'm going to start with the really small. What you described, so we, about a year and a half ago, we had one of our really good friends come and live with us for a few months. And he wasn't a guest really, he was a roommate. And we joke frequently that he was the best possible roommate of all time, not just because he would wash all of our dishes during the day while we were at work. but he also restrung our entire Wi-Fi system while he was there. And because he was using our guest best bedroom as his office while he was staying with us. And so, you know, he figured out this whole system for extending the Wi-Fi, not just in the living room where we'd been using it before, because we didn't really care about getting good Wi-Fi signal in the bedrooms, the whole way back to the bedroom. And guess what? That was sort of this like thing that at the time seemed a little bit ridiculous and unnecessary to us. It wasn't like it really added to our experience in that moment. But now here, a year and a half later, it's the only reason why we're able to actually use our home office. And that lent itself to so much more, you know, us being able to totally work from home and be, you know, it created this sense of tov because we were able to carry it into doing the work that we do, but doing it differently from home.
Cast your bread upon the waters, for after many days you will find it. So here's some bread that was cast upon the waters. Yeah. It would take many days before it was found.
Yeah.
Yeah, please keep going.
Yeah, but then it made me think of the entire history of the Jewish people, of being really guests in so many cultures and places, and all of the, you know, both the effort to be, you know, guests and to sort of add our value to those places. But then also just these pieces that we picked up along the way, recipes are a really easy way to see that, traditions. And I think when you think of those things as these like meaningful souvenirs, that have now become incorporated into our culture versus, there's like a really cool image of sort of thinking about all of the places that you've been. If you see yourself as a productive guest, not just a, it's not just like you try to leave it the same way you found it. I think that was really interesting to me.
Mega bravo. And we are being influenced as we are influencing others. And just to track on it, because I felt you added so much to what Jonah was saying, and you put in the word, am I a guest to the land, to return us to Deuteronomy 30 in a way that brings forth Tov, or am I a guest to the land or the set of relationships that brings forth Ra? Quick reminder, Ra means evil. And to understand that if it is Ra, then, and it's Ra for too long a period of time, I don't mean one action, but I mean generationally, Ra over the course of time, then the fruit of that will be exile. So if all that's making sense, why are we being told that now?
I think it's a reminder that the work is not one in one moment. It's not, the work is not just to get into the promised land. The work is what it means to sort of stay in the promised land and be engaged and to not sort of get too comfortable, but not in the way of sort of, you know, it's not that you know that once you get into the promised land, then you get to rest and all your work is done and you're stagnant, but really to see yourself as a reflection of a God that is, I will be what I will be, and that is continually changing and evolving and investing in the spaces and the people that you are a part of.
I guess the easy way to describe it would be like not to take it for granted, but even more so than that, it's like the Israelites will not need all of the promised land. They're not going to need to farm and cultivate and take care of all of it. But in a sense, they still should. Because it would be really easy to say, here is my farm, here is my house, and here is my landfill, right? Or here is the river I use, and here is the river I don't care about. And obviously that has really easily like modern day implications, but it's also the same thing of, my mother will tell you that in my own home, I would say, here is my space, and this is the bed I use, and the dishes that were mine, and the dishes that weren't mine, and the space that I didn't make dirty, right? And then I also think, like, I have this vision of, like, you, like, Hannah walking into the temple with a mask on. And before the mask, before leaving the temple, you would have walked into the temple kind of treading loudly, if you will. And we can't walk into the temple again treading lightly, but we've got to know that it is, we've got to care for it in its whole. It's not take it for granted, but care for it. But and not take it for granted and care for it. It's in its entirety, which is the physical space and the people who exist not within that space. Right? Our caring community initiatives have never been better, or at least in my lifetime. We're caring for people not just within the space, but in their whole, in their entirety.
Really well said.
Yeah, there's been a couple of moments where I've worked at TBE now for 10 years, and there have been a couple of moments where somebody new comes in and takes a tour of the building or walks in for the first time, and I meet them in the atrium and they say, wow, this space is so beautiful. And anytime they say that, it's a reminder to me that I just take it, you know, I take it for granted. I walk into the space and it's sort of like, you don't see it, you know, you don't see it. It's like the entry table at our house, which is covered in mail that we don't really pay any, you know, we don't even see anymore. You know, it's whether it's good or bad, we're not aware of it. I'm not aware of it. And when I walk into the building, I don't always every single day have that immense feeling of like, wow, it's incredible. This, space that we have. I should be grateful for it. So that's one piece that reminded me of. But then the other piece that I thought of was, what has happened in the last, I don't know, number of weeks, who's counting the days anymore, is an understanding that the beauty of our building is not, or the beauty of our community is not our building, it's the people who've extended beyond the walls, just like you said, to care for each other, to connect with each other, to understand that there's still some kind of sacred connection and community, and that that community exists far beyond the walls. And without this exile, we would never have realized, I don't think, that our community is beautiful, not because our building is beautiful, but because the power of community, sacred community, is in itself beautiful.
When all these things befall you, the blessing and the curse. Quick reminder, the word for blessing is bracha. Baruch has the root berech, and berech means
knee,
exactly right. So the word for blessing is literally the word knee. So what might we understand from this?
If you bend the knee, if you sort of, that's sort of a significant sign of respect to something else. So if you sort of lower yourself, that's one piece. But then also, if you don't have very functional knees, it's very difficult to walk. You can't move forward. You can't sort of go somewhere. And so I think a blessing is something that you take and then you walk forward with, rather than something that you hold on to and then stay. You know, you don't just like stand still and receive the blessing. You have to, you know, receive it, bend down, and then walk with it in order to actually bring forward and fulfill the blessing.
So I was with a program called the Diller Program, which is a group of, for the moment, Israelis and Americans that get together in Israel, and 20 Bostonians and 20 students from Haifa, and we were given a day, like groups, split into groups and given one day to plan touring in Haifa. And my group was essentially religious diversity. And we, out of a couple of really interesting twists and turns and trying to email and plan in advance, end up in a mosque in Haifa with somebody from that community who speaks brilliant English and is talking to us and showing us around the mosque and talking to us about the religion. And the Bostonians are kind of like, yeah, okay, cool, this is interesting. And the Israelis, who are all Jewish, are wide-eyed, and maybe one has been in a mosque before. And I was helping lead the day, and the man ended up asking me to come up and demonstrate a couple of prayer rituals, and eventually had me like prostrate myself on the floor. And again, the Americans were like, cool. And the Israelis afterward were like, Jonah, like you felt comfortable like bending to your knees and in like a mosque and like prostrating and questions constantly, like you felt comfortable doing this. And the group was pluralistic, so it was some like Reform, but some also like Orthodox Israelis, and all asking me this. And this moment for me just really ties in the sense what we've been talking about being yes, and also allowing ourselves to be bent and molded and shaped. Because here are Americans who are staying in the Israeli students' homes as guests, who are also in Israel as guests, who are now all with their Israeli counterparts being welcomed into a mosque as guests. And thousands of miles from home, the Americans are almost feel more at home. And the Israelis have a lot of discomfort here in the mosque. And the point I'm trying to strike is that the knee, the blessing allows us to bend and be flexible, and as Hannah said, move forward and literally walk forward. If you will allow me, walk to ourselves, and when we're perhaps in exile, we're also perhaps just living within the diaspora, which can be a blessing in itself.
I love that you brought us to Lech Lecha, the idea of walking towards yourself. And I think there's like a sense, like you can't grow until you walk forward and then reintegrate that into yourself. And that story was so powerful because I think there's something, the piece that you brought into it was a little bit of humility, of not thinking that you are more important than someone else and not letting your own discomfort sort of get in the way of an opportunity for growth. And wow, there's just so much there. So
yeah, I'm in. So I just want to return to the text for a moment and remember that there's somebody by the name of Jacob, but his name literally means heel. And heel in Genesis 32 is asking a man, except for Jacob calls him God, and almost every artist paints the man as an angel. But and Jacob is asking the man for a knee, a blessing. When he gets the blessing, he walks differently and he walks away with a name change. He is Israel. And so the act of receiving a blessing is to truly be transformed into who you can become, even if you never had the idea of it prior to the moment of receiving it. And in that sense, the idea of humility, can I just see that maybe there's a lot more that could be, but I can't see it from here. I don't think if you asked Jacob an hour before, he would have had any understanding that he was about to become Israel. And the dimensions of Israel are so many, but just to name one, that's the end of Genesis 32, when the passage that we were just talking about. In Genesis 37, for the very first time, Israel will ask one of his sons to see to the shalom of his brothers and the shalom of their flocks. No parent had ever thought to ask a child to do that. And what does it mean to be transformed? Suddenly you're thinking things that literally nobody has thought before you. And you're thinking things that you yourself can't do. You actually have to ask somebody else to do it because you won't live long enough. You're not the right person for the job. And in a sense, that so draws us into Deuteronomy 30. for all the amazing, amazing, amazing things Moses has done, he's not the right person for the job. He's going to have to hand it off to the next generation. And to ask the next generation to do things that he's literally never done. And if I had to pick one of the things that I think defines great leadership, it's asking the future to do what's not been done in the present. Otherwise, you're just saying, hey, just do what we've already done. We've already done it, but do it again. Mm-hmm. Really? So that's just a quick layering in of the text into the conversation about blessing, and that blessing is quintessentially transformational. So the word curse is the word klala, and klala literally means to be light as in weight. So that which is cursed is literally light as in weight, meaning?
Literally, it doesn't have any matter to it, but it's sort of pointless. Which begs a question for me based on our conversation a couple of weeks ago, which is, what is the difference between something that is a curse and something that is vapor?
Okay. What a great question. The word bina means to understand in biblical or modern Hebrew. But bina has the root bane, and bane means to distinguish one thing from another. For example, bane or lechoshech gets translated between light and darkness, but really to distinguish between light and darkness. And you just asked such an exquisite question. What does it mean to distinguish between that which is light in weight, that which doesn't matter? I'll use another word, that which is ephemeral, and that which is vapor, that which is ruach, that which is spirit, and that which is eternal. And I'm going to say that there's another key word that's helpful here, and that's the word kabod, or kabed. And kabed literally means to be weighty. So I want to suggest we've all been in moments where suddenly the moment is weighty. It's just a moment. And yet it's so intense, and you feel it so. And then there's all the times we try to make a moment that we'd like to think is weighty, but it's not. And we want it to be so badly because we think it's supposed to be, but it just wasn't there. And it's not about me deciding it's weighty. It's rather the people who are gathered experience that weightiness.
I think to distinguish sort of between this idea of curse and vapor or things that don't matter and things that hold ruach, it's that the feeling that you get around it. You know, you can kind of feel the presence or you don't. And I think we create a lot of rituals that are meant to sort of feel the presence. You know, I think graduation is one of them. Prom, one of them. The weddings, definitely one of them. But there's those are events that are meant to sort of contain the presence of it. And I think often they can. But the presence isn't something that is contained. I we were really lucky to be in the presence of two of our friends who shared with us last night that they just got engaged, you know, and that is like, it's vapor, you know, the only physical manifestation of it is a ring, which is sort of just a symbol of covenant, but, and in itself doesn't really matter, even though it's really beautiful. But the vapor and the ruach part of it is like this like really significant choice to be with each other and to walk with each other for their lives. And whether or not, you know, a wedding happens in the near future that is going to look like weddings that happened in the past, it doesn't really matter. The presence is there of the commitment to each other.
Jonah, you were going to say.
Well, that was beautiful.
Yeah. First of all.
That was just one after the other. It's just very...
Yeah. Instantly.
I love the way you answered your question, incidentally. Just loved it.
Incidentally, it's the same friend who installed Wi-Fi all throughout our apartment. So.
Really? Well, there you go. Speak about two things. One, that the proms and the weddings can be weighty. Right? It's really easy in, especially like movies, to portray them as tacky and cheesy, and that those moments really can be full of weight. But you're not going to go from the day before your wedding feeling nothing to feeling complete weight on the wedding day. Or at least that's what they've told me. And that, like, that weight can't be contained, as you said. If it's going to exist, it's not going to appear and disappear instantly. It's going to build gradually, and at some point probably fall away. And it's interesting when we were talking about, when we originally started talking about vapor versus like being light, not full of matter. I had this image in my head for a long time when I started learning about like trying to travel at light speed and like literally how we might travel at light speed. That if you put a feather on a river, that feather is going to flow down the river at the speed of the river. It's going to be pushed along at the speed. And that my thinking was always, why can't we do that with light in some way? Put something in the light waves that literally get pushed along at the speed of light. And it's funny when you think about the river, because it doesn't have to be a feather. It can be a huge boat, it can be a big boat that carries a lot of weight and a lot of people. And ignoring the scientific implications of this, but that we can be full of weight and be transient and in motion.
The flow piece is what is so, that, I mean, that's like a thing that's been moving through this conversation, is this idea of understanding that there is flow and that you're not staying rigid. It's sort of like if you're, again, using another water metaphor, if you're in the ocean and there's a wave coming in, you can try, and I usually do and fail miserably, to stand your ground and just, you know, brace yourself against the wave, or you can float on top of the wave, or dive into the wave. You know, there's ways that you can kind of be that are you holding on really strongly to where you are, and there's other ways of being where you literally understand that you're sort of flowing in it. And that's ultimately much more stable.
So I'm sad to say this, but questions, comments, thoughts?
I was recently thinking about and reading about tracking Jewish people from through mountains, and how often we think about rising up to God to meet God, rising up on the Bema, but also tracking Jewish religion through waters and rivers and seas. And I found that especially resonant, frankly, as thinking about the American diaspora, about the people who came here over some really powerful water journeys that were both powerful and strong and also really harmful and hurtful. And thinking about from things like how the first humans got here, likely crossing an ice bridge to the Mayflower, to also the Middle Passage of carrying slaves to the United States, how my ancestors came here on ships that looked very different from those of the 16th century, and the water allows for this just flow that mountains in my head don't.
Yeah, there's so many yummy study sessions around rivers and mountains in Torah. I guess it's one thing time. So one thing you're going to take away.
If we think about ourselves as guests on a journey in movement, then we realize that A, we have to make everything around us a little bit as the same or better than we found it. And we have the opportunity to pick up wisdom, to pick up and carry with us things that are weighty and matter along our journey. And also to see ourselves in movement, sort of flowing through our experiences.
I'm gonna very much be with the thing you said, Hannah, about distinguishing or unpacking how we see the spectrum of relationship between light and weight to vapor and ruach. And I must confess, about an 8-part study session sort of clicked in my brain as we were talking about it. But that will have to be for the other side of the sabbatical. But it's just fun to start to see that and be inside of it. So thank you.
I'll take away just the recognizing when moments carry weight, and that it won't be instantaneous.
Yeah. And that when they carry weight, there won't always be matter that is associated with those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, thank you all, always. So fun, so much fun. This is a great place to pause.